17,897. 17,897. That is not how many yards that the opponents of the Dallas Cowboys have against them this year. It's not that. It's not that. It's not how many Republican presidential candidates there are. It's also, for those of you who might be wondering, not how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. I know that's a burning question for you all. That number reflects how many strips were composed and drawn by Charles Schulz in his 50 years of doing Peanuts comic strip, 17,897. And there is one thing that never happened in 17,897 strips. Charlie Brown never kicked the football that Lucy had teed up. Not once. Hundreds, literally hundreds of opportunities. Hundreds of attempts. Hundreds of times where Charlie Brown was thinking, this is gonna be the day. Not once. Not once. Now, if Charles Schulz had let Charlie Brown age, we would not have been surprised to one day find Charlie Brown on a park bench having stolen Lannis's blanket and drinking a fifth of bourbon. But he didn't. The children never grew up. And you know what happens then? Charlie Brown kind of wears his melancholy on his sleeve, right? He says stuff like this. Like, here's some of my favorite melancholy comments from Charlie Brown. Ready? There must be millions of people all over the world who never get any love letters. I could be their leader. Nothing takes the taste out of peanut butter quite like unrequited love. Or this is the best one. I think I'm afraid of being happy. Because whenever I get too happy, something bad always happens. It's not that he goes through tragedies, right? Like, the worst thing that ever happens to him is his ice cream falls on the ground or he's pitching and the rain falls. That nothing really bad happens to him, but nothing really fantastic or exciting really thrills him, right? And so he's just kind of melancholy. He's a kid that wants to hope, but he's afraid to hope. And brothers and sisters, that is more than the storyline of a comic strip. We all have an internal sense of what it would be to be optimal, what it would like to be wonderful and bountiful and enduringly good. But given the way life unfolds, it kind of feels more like something, a lot of what happens way underneath that sense of what it could be. And so we wonder, is it even worth hoping in something enduringly blessed? We're in the fourth week of Advent. We're in the fourth week of considering the brief but rich story about Ruth and Naomi. This Sunday, we're going to consider what you might consider the culmination of the storyline. And the tension of the culmination here in chapter 4 is that something might happen, and it can go of one of two directions. It can either be absolutely wonderful and beautiful that makes us all go, oh, captivating, or it could turn into something adequate but mostly disappointing. Kind of meh. And in a moment like that, it is a metaphor for us all. Is it worth hoping? When the way things usually turn out, it's about meh. We're going to listen to the last part of Ruth chapter 4, and we're going to consider what it means to live with the possibility of hope, even when life wants to steal it at every turn. And we're going to see it in three ways. In the righteous resolve of a relative, in a rescue that's redolent with love, and in a resurrection of sorts. Righteous resolve, a rescue, and a resurrection. Would you stand? Gordon and Susan are going to read chapter 4, the first 12 verses of Ruth.
Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And the man said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. For Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephratah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. May we see you.
The only thing greater than the tragedy that began the very story of Ruth was the response in the wake of that tragedy. A family, for those of you that are not familiar with the story, has left its hometown. It needs food. And in that day, you couldn't pop down to the grocery store. You had to move to a new region. And so this family does. And it settles in a place that Israel considered off limits, a place that was repugnant to Israel. It's the place of Moab. The region of Moab, it had a sordid history in Israel's lives, in Israel's histories. And there in that place where this family, just looking for food, settles, the husband dies, leaves a widow behind. And then the two sons of that family, they had married and married Moabite women. And then those two sons die and leave these women, these wives behind. And what's remarkable about these younger widows that are Moabite is that Israelites just didn't marry people from the region of Moab. Israel had a really bad habit of becoming so assimilated with other peoples that they had forgotten the God who had brought them out of slavery into a new and promised land. These Moabite widows, one of whom stays in her own land. But the other one, her name is Ruth, she prefers to accompany her mother-in-law Naomi back to the little town of Bethlehem. And it's this Ruth who has everything to gain by staying put in Moab, everything to gain by staying with what was familiar and what was comfortable, and everything to lose by going back to a land that she didn't know and to a people who would very likely hold her in contempt. But for love of her mother-in-law and for reverence of the God of Israel, she goes anyway. And desperate to find food for her and her mother-in-law, she happens to meet a man named Boaz. He's a distant relative of Naomi's dead husband, but he has shown eminent concern and care, not just for his men, but even for this foreign woman named Ruth. He provides her ample grain. He treats her with a kindness she never would have expected. And so much so that even as we heard last Sunday, Naomi believes that Boaz might be willing to do a little bit more than just supply Ruth and Naomi with grain. Naomi thinks that Boaz might be willing to fulfill an Israelite custom, a custom whereby a relative would take the widow of a deceased husband, and that relative would take that woman as his own. And in a moment last week that was altogether foreign to our ears, there is an overture that is made from none other than Ruth herself. She asks that Boaz might marry her. And the only thing more striking in that moment is that Boaz is willing to do just that. But then there's this hitch, which creates the tension for the moment that we find ourselves in chapter 4 today. See, there's another relative who, according to the Israelite custom, had a more rightful claim to take Ruth as his own, a nearer relative. And unless that nearer relative differs, Boaz has no opportunity, has no claim to take Ruth as his own. And it's to that stipulation that Boaz has to subscribe. And it's where we begin here, and it's where we have a fork in the road. It is the impasse of the moment. How's it going to resolve? That's the question that everybody asks when they come to chapter 4. And what we see first in this moment is this. We find the righteous resolve of a relative. The first time we have ever heard about Boaz, again, for those of you that are not familiar with the narrative, we learn that he's a distant relative of this deceased husband. And we see righteousness writ large in him. The men who work for him, he owns land, they thresh his grain, they hold him in high regard. He holds them with great respect. And that is a righteousness that is real. A righteousness that is amplified in how he treats, without batting an eye, this young woman who shows up near his land, who's a Moabite. He could have totally ignored her, written her off, maybe just sort of waited until she wandered off to find somebody else to help her, but he doesn't. He notices her. He seeks her welfare at cost to himself. And that righteousness that we saw last week when Ruth makes herself available right there and then on the threshing floor at night with everybody else asleep, she offers herself as a bride. But he knew that she was not his to have. Another had a more rightful place. And so here in chapter 4, Boaz means to bring this matter to a resolution, and quickly, whether he ends up being part of the solution or not. Because brothers and sisters, that's what righteousness does. It seeks a good end for another, regardless of whether you benefit from it. That's what righteousness does. Now, politics, we're in a political season. We're in an unrelenting political season, right? And politics is nearly always premised on the notion that if you will scratch my back, I will scratch yours. It's a quid pro quo world. And that's how the only way stuff gets done around here. And even at the interpersonal level, across history, so much of our benevolence to one another is really an act whereby we are making an implicit claim on their reciprocity. We give to get. That's not what is in Boaz's resolve here. If he gets nothing, he gets nothing, so long as Naomi and Ruth are adequately cared for. And so he goes to what is known as the city gate. It's where public business was done. It's where decisions were made. It's like city hall. You want to get stuff done? You go to the city planning commission. Right? You make your overture. You make debates. You make an argument. They rule. whether for you or against you. And there Boaz waits. He waits for this near relative who just happens to walk by. Boaz asks him, hey, turn aside, sit down for a second. I got to ask you a question. And in a narrative, which, if you noticed, is plentiful, and where names show up all the time, and those names have all sorts of meaning, it's rather remarkable that this nearer relative ends up as nameless. Literally, in the Hebrew there, it's Mr. So-and-so. That's as good as he gets. He comes, he sits, he listens. At which point Boaz asks the elders of the town, boys, sit, listen. I got to ask you a question. They turn, they sit, they listen. What's with all the sitting? Why is he saying sit? Because it's formal. Just like a court sits in judgment. This is a moment that is asking to be ratified. This is a moment, this is a deal when things are going to be finalized, and that deal is going to have massive implications. That's what all the sitting is about. And with everyone sitting and listening attentively, Boaz explains the reason for the formality. Everybody knows Naomi has been gone for 10 years. She's back. And she's back from Moab. And she has this piece of land, but she's too old to work it. She can't do it. And she doesn't have the funds to hire a bunch of people to work it for her. She can only sell it if she's going to benefit from it. When you've got no income stream, you run back to your assets, right? You sell some of that, so you're going to have means to survive. That's what she's doing. But it was built into the law of Israel in Leviticus 25 that a person in a need like Naomi would look to somebody called a goel, a relative who would come to the aid of the strapped family member so that they wouldn't have to give up the land that was part of their family. We have made this comparison before, but if you've ever read Gone with the Wind, to the O'Hara family, Tara was everything. That's what you hear in the movie, Tara, Tara, Tara. Tara was huge. Tara wasn't just property, it was their life. It was their sustenance, it was their identity. To lose the property was to lose a part of themselves. That's what we see in this moment in Israelite history. And that's what the goel was out to be a protector of. To supply the necessary capital so that that family could keep the land. And Boaz is there to tell everybody, including this unnamed relative, that he is entitled, according to Leviticus 25, to act as the goel on behalf of Naomi by purchasing the land and permitting her to retain it while he simultaneously benefits from it. What he's doing is acting righteously. He could have kept that detail to himself. This near relative wasn't on the prowl looking to know whether he could be of assistance to Naomi. But he knew the family, and he knew the law, and he knew his Lord. And so he acted with righteous resolve. But there's something more at work. There's something more to the purpose behind this righteous resolve than just the purchase of land. Which leads us to the second thing that we're going to see here that's meant to give us a sense of what hope is about and why we're meant to live with hope. The goel, as I've said, is translated literally as the word redeemer. And that goel, if you know the law of Moses, would serve in a variety of contexts. Here, it's about purchasing land so a family that can keep it. If you had a debt, they would pay it. But a goel would also would come to your aid in this sense too. If your debt was so large and you didn't have the means to pay it, you could sell yourself into slavery. Not like the version of modern slavery we think of today, more like of an indentured servitude where you would pay off a debt by selling yourself unto their care. You would work for them until you paid it off. The goel would be the one to buy you back from that slavery that you had to purchase yourself. Boaz is asking if this near relative wants to exercise his right to serve as the redeemer of the family. And without batting an eye, this near relative says, I'm in. Slam dunk deal. He gets the land at cost to himself. That's it. But then he gets to work that land and reap the profits from it such that it's going to pay itself off in due time. And so he's thinking to himself, this is a no-brainer. Of course, I will act as the goel. And we who read this story think, see, it's Charlie Brown all over again, to speak anachronistically, right? Not only is Charlie Brown going to miss the field, he's going to watch that little red-haired girl drift away into the distance. Ruth and Boaz will not be together. Boaz will have nothing to do with being a redeemer for Elimelech's land. All it works like that. And such is life. Que sera, sera, right? Such is life. Until it's not. Boaz at this moment springs the little caveat. When the Redeemer buys the parcel of land, he says, if you're going to fulfill the entirety of what it means to be the Goel, then you also have to take Ruth as your wife. Because as a true Goel who is interested in prospering that family and preserving it, that name and keeping it in the family, then he's going to have to help produce an heir. Naomi, the nearer relative, thought, she's too old. She can't bear children. There's no sense in me having to take her on anything. But see, there was an heir. His name was Mahlon, and he died, and Ruth was his wife, and now Ruth is somebody that he's going to have to take. And if he's going to produce an heir through Ruth, then everything changes. Not only is he going to lose that land that he's bought because he's going to have to give it to the heir, but now his own inheritance is going to have to be more widely distributed to his own children and to any children that might come from his life with Ruth. And he thinks to himself, I think it's time to recalculate. Because in an instant, the deal of the complexion has changed. The complexion of the deal has changed. And he turns white as a sheet, and he runs the numbers, and then he says, sorry, I'm out. This, her, it's all you, Boaz. Do with it as you please. And Boaz says, don't mind if I do. Let's shake on it. And the way you shook on it in that day was the one giving over his right to redeem the land would take off his sandal and hand it to the one who was electing to do that. So that's the deal, and it's closed. That's what happened. But what really happened here? Boaz has promised to pay out of pocket for the land belonging to Naomi so that she can keep it. That's going to cost him. But this is more than drachmas and shekels. This is more than bushels and barrels. Boaz has promised to take Ruth, not just to produce an heir, but to take her as a wife. The law didn't really stipulate that you had to enter into like a full marriage with somebody that you would help produce an heir through. It didn't require that you entered into a relationship of affection and friendship, only that a relationship would be formed so that an heir might be produced. But Boaz has chosen her in love. And not just for the sake of pragmatism. And that's going to cost him. But it will cost him in the currency of love. What is his shall become hers. And at the same time that he is buying land back from Naomi, Boaz is uniting himself to Ruth in love. Today, when you hear the word redemption, we usually think of an inner transformation. And it's that. It's got a great broad range of lexical meaning. But at the heart of Boaz being a redeemer here, of transacting a redemption, at the heart of that is the notion of rescue. Rescuing somebody from a debt. Rescuing somebody from an enslavement. And also rescuing somebody from guilt. Because you know what a goel would also do if the circumstance called for it? If there was a family member who had committed a sin, that goel would remunerate the person against whom the sin had been committed to absolve them of the guilt. And that's what redeemers did. Boaz has rescued Naomi from a plight of poverty and fear. He's rescued Ruth from a life of wandering among a world full of enemies. In being a redeemer, he has rescued, but not like a rescuer who sort of comes, does the work, and then goes back to the firehouse. He has rescued, by uniting them all to him in love at cost and for love. The whole deal is finalized by this little ritual, but you can't call what's happened here a mere transaction. This is a rescue redolent with love. But it's that rescue that has a significance that's deeper than what it affords to all those that are present at that moment. In fact, it's not too much to say that this rescue is akin to a resurrection. And that's the third thing we see here. At the gate, before the elders, having chosen to walk in another man's sandal, if you will, Boaz restates to everybody what he's really doing here. And he says in verse 9, "Your witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Kilhon and Mahlon. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have brought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place." Yes, he's bought some land. Yes, he's taken a wife. But Boaz has acted, if you will, to resurrect a name from the dead, to give it standing again, to give it a title to life, even in death. See, the word name there is big. Your name was more than just what people called you. Your name was you in your fullness. It's why Scripture will speak of the name of the Lord to refer to God in his fullness, not just his nature, but his full character, his history, his identity. Without one to produce an heir for Elimelech, he would, in a sense, cease to exist. His name and with it himself would be forgotten. That's what's at stake here in this mindset. Boaz has seen fit to retrieve Elimelech's name from a near certain death by taking on a wife that it might bring forth an heir that his name would be remembered. And in so doing, he lives on. What looked like a final death has now become a form of resurrection. His name is going to endure. And we hear that and we think, wow, that's weird. Maybe even a little regressive and pathetically sentimental. Like, who goes to all the trouble to preserve a name or a memory of someone? Who does that? Who does? We do. It's why we put names on buildings and in endowments and on landscapes and on paintings. We believe our name means something more than just an identifier. It means that something of us persists. It's also why we speak of the idea of being relevant or of, quote, wanting to make a difference. We still use the words, he's out to make a name for himself, because we still feel that unless something of us is memorable, we haven't lived or that we're already dead. It's just the language of wanting to preserve our name, but in different words. When you're in your 20s, you dream about making a name for yourself. At midlife, you wonder how that name project is coming along. And then towards the end of your life, you either bemoan or at least are at best ambivalent about whether that name that you sought to make has really turned out like you thought it would. We want our name to last. We want our memory to last. And if we could, we want ourselves to last. So before you write off this story as a throwback to an obsolete age, think again. What Boaz did for Elimelech is what we want to have done for us. Boaz is out to resurrect a name, but at the same time, he's out to resurrect a promise. We have asked ourselves throughout the whole story of Ruth, why has the author chosen to write a story about a Moabite woman, and why has he taken such pains to make sure we all remember, hey, she's from Moab? I think we conclude for at least one reason why he is making a hay about Ruth's ethnicity. It's this: Israel would often forget about the earliest promise that God made to it. Namely, that through Abraham, all the nations of the world would be blessed. that those who are outside Israel would be called to come within Israel, within the people of God. You've heard me quote Psalm 87 before when the psalmist says, among those who know me, I mention Rahab and Babylon, Philistia and Tyre with Cush. This one was born there. Singers and dancers alike say, all my springs are in you. What's common to about all those nations and names? They were all enemies of Israel. But the psalmist is remembering God's promise that all the nations who are outside might come inside. Ruth, this so-called outsider, was in fact of interest to God, even though Israel may have forgotten. And it's Boaz who has sought to resurrect the promise that Israel might have just as soon let die. The righteous resolve of a relative works a rescue redolent with love to bring forth the resurrection of a name and a promise. That's the storyline of Ruth, brothers and sisters. But you know what it also is? That's the gospel of Jesus in miniature. The contours of this tiny episode in Israelite history trace out in parallel to what we know of Jesus and his incarnation. Ruth is the gospel in miniature, first in how it just anticipates what Jesus will do himself. Jesus is the relative who acted with a righteous resolve. He was, as Paul said, the firstborn among many brethren like us. He was the one, as the author of Hebrews says, who partook of flesh and blood as we are. He was, as the author of Hebrews says, the one who was like us in every way except without sin. He is a relative. And he was righteousness embodied. He is that righteous one who came to rescue us with love. We are indebted to a degree we could not pay. We were enslaved to a sin and a destiny from which we could not liberate ourselves. Brothers and sisters, we were guilty. And it was Jesus that came to rescue, not just to settle an account like a banker, but to unite us to himself in love and to give us what is his and make us his own. And with resolve, he rescued and thereby resurrected a name and a promise. Boaz served to rescue a name that was going to be forgotten in history. Jesus comes to rescue us from being lost to what Scripture calls the book of life. He's that dude. He works that kind of rescue. And he offers himself as a redeemer to those who are inside Israel and to those who are outside Israel who will only listen and follow. The story of Ruth anticipates what Jesus would do. But the story of Ruth also gives us a picture of what the gospel inspires anyone who has become convinced of what Jesus has done. Ruth reminds us of what Jesus will do, but Ruth shows us what it means to have been captivated by what Jesus did. The degree to which you've become convinced of being shown an eternal kindness is the degree to which you're going to forget yourself to show others that kindness. We saw that in Boaz. We saw that in Ruth. We see that in Naomi. But by seeing Jesus' resolve, you find your resolve. Because you find yourself wanting to be like him, even on the days when you don't feel like being like him. Trusting in his rescue frees you to sacrifice yourself for others' rescue. Because of all those hesitations that you have about sacrificing yourself for another's good, when you realize what he did to rescue you, you are freed. Those fears are swallowed up, and you realize that anything that you might lose here is nothing that you won't have more of when his kingdom fully comes. The sooner you see yourself, brothers and sisters, in the divine economy as a refugee who had nowhere to find safe haven than in the grace of God, the sooner that you're going to labor at cost and in love to provide safe haven for those who are likewise convinced of their status as refugees. Brothers and sisters, who has happened to come upon your field, if you will, that might benefit from your kindness? That's what this story is asking of us. But with Ruth, if you will, singing a prelude to Jesus' greatest aria, we have something here that lets us hope without regret, even when life does its level best to steal hope from us. Let me put it this way. Teed up footballs are meant to be kicked. Babies are meant to survive the womb and thrive in life. Goals are meant to be met. Aspirations are meant to be achieved. And we are right and meet to want those outcomes. It's fitting. But when we can't have them, when the ball is, metaphorically speaking, repeatedly pulled out from beneath us, when our hopes end in tears, when our dreams are left unmet, even if we should land flat on our back in something or in all things, there was one who lost all so that in us not all would be lost. There was one who loved all so that we might love in kind. This life, brothers and sisters, doesn't promise you a happy ending. In this life, you'll have trouble, Jesus said. But he said, take heart. I've overcome it. As in the life of Ruth, as in the gospel of Jesus, even when happiness eludes us, there is a blessedness that is ours. For in what looked like a colossal failure in Jesus to show up on the outskirts of a backwater town for a baby to spend its opening hours in a trough, that did not have the marks of a promising future. And yet what looked like a colossal failure turned out to be Jesus' greatest triumph, a triumph that he does not keep to himself, but a triumph that he shares with anybody who will trust him. And that is why we can agree with Bonhoeffer, who said this, which is on the front of your bulletin. The world lives by the blessing of God and of the righteous, and thus has a future. Blessing means laying one's hands on something and saying, despite everything, you belong to God. This is what we do with the world that inflicts such suffering on us. We do not abandon it. We do not repudiate, despise, or condemn it. Instead, we call it back to God. We give it hope. We lay our hand on it and say, may God's blessing come upon you. May God renew you. Be blessed, world created by God, you who belong to your Creator and Redeemer. Brothers and sisters, that is the story of Ruth. That is the story of the gospel, and that can be your story if you trust in that story. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.